Welcome to Making Therapy Better, the podcast that brings together some of the top minds in psychotherapy and related fields to talk about how we can achieve better mental health care for everyone. Making Therapy Better is hosted by Professor Bruce Wampold, who has dedicated his career to understanding how therapy works and advocating evidence-based methods for improving outcomes. His guest today is Nancy McWilliams, PhD. Nancy is Emerita Visiting Professor of Psychology at Rutgers University and a former president of the American Psychological Association's Division of Psychoanalysis. She is the author of several books, including Psychoanalytic Diagnosis and Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy, A Practitioner's Guide. She is the recipient of numerous awards, including the Rosalie Weiss Award, the Laughlin Distinguished Teacher Award, and awards for leadership, scholarship, and international academic excellence from the APA Division of Psychoanalysis. She also maintains a private practice in Lambertville, New Jersey. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths has been helping in-person and virtual therapy practices thrive for over 20 years with their complete web-based EHR and practice management platform. CarePaths provides free tools to help therapists as well as clients benefit from the power of measurement-based care to improve therapy outcomes. Visit CarePaths.com to start your free trial, and clients should look for the free Making Therapy Better app, now available for iPhone and Android. And now, without further ado, Episode 16 of Making Therapy Better, Psychoanalytic Diagnosis and Supervision, with Nancy McWilliams, PhD.
Nancy, it's a great pleasure to speak with you today. I remember well when we were on a panel together at APA, I think. And, you know, I've done hundreds of presentations, but I was really captivated by what you had to say, the cogency of it, the clarity of it, the way you said it. It was just really captivating and informative. So I'm really looking forward to
discussing. Thank you. I remember that panel.
Yeah.
Just feeling a bit intimidated because I think I was the only full-time clinician on the panel. And I think Lilienfeld was on it, too, who's been quite a critic of psychoanalytic treatment.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking, well, this was my shot to speak for practicing therapists to important people. I've followed your work ever since the great psychotherapy debate, so I appreciate it.
Great. Well, that really is a good introduction to the leading question, because I want to ask you about psychoanalysis. You're a psychoanalytic therapist. You know, many in the field consider psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic-based therapies as anachronism, something we should read in history of psychotherapy, but not really relevant to what people are trained to do, are doing, are paid to do. So briefly, tell us what you do, and more importantly, why you do it.
Well, like all therapists, however we're trained, I meet with people who are suffering terribly, and I try to help them with what they're suffering with. And I have found in the psychoanalytic literature more rich and useful ways of thinking about their suffering and finding a way to intervene than I have from the paradigms that result mostly from certain kinds of short-term research that are important to do, but that often don't speak to the experience of therapists. I mean, for research, for example, very often subjects are cherry-picked. You want a person with one disorder, not comorbid with anything else. Well, right there, I can't think of a single patient of mine that has one disorder, not comorbid with anything else, according to the DSM. You have to manualize what you're doing for research purposes. And yet, if you operate with patients as if you're reading from a manual, they get very turned off. They don't want to be treated like, a cookbook therapy would treat them. They tend to, in research paradigms, you have to have a baseline of symptoms, and then you have to figure what symptoms have been reduced. But in real psychotherapy, we're not quite as focused on symptoms. And I think that's not just specific to psychodynamic people. It's you know, behaviorally oriented people, if you're trying to get somebody to engage in a new behavior that's different from their pattern, they're going to be more anxious. They're going to test worse on an anxiety scale. If they're mourning finally a terrible loss that they have used denial about, they're going to test worse on a Beck depression inventory than they did. So short-term symptom reduction isn't that critical to actual practicing therapists. It is for researchers because it's measurable. But I do what I do because I find that what patients are most interested in are things that we have had a harder time researching, including trying to feel more safe in the world, attachment security, trying to feel more agentic in the world, having some sense of constancy of the self, having some capacity to regulate their affects, having self-esteem that's reliable and realistic, having, you know, being able to reflect on themselves and understand the separate subjectivities of others, having vitality, being able to accept things that can't be changed and grieve and move on rather than getting stuck in complaining, and working toward better quality of life in their love, in their work, in their play. So I think the psychoanalytic clinical literature is full of ideas about how to help people with all that. The cognitive behavioral literature is in many ways reinventing psychoanalytic understandings of things. You know, we call things implicit rather than unconscious, for example. So, I mean, I think this is an issue that that affects all therapists. So how we can treat the whole person in the ways that the person finds salient, not necessarily what researchers have to study in short-term versions of research that are usually all people can get grants for.
I resonate with what you're saying, but a lot of people come to therapy wanting a quick fix. Look, I want to get through this problem. I don't really want to spend the time delving into these kind of unconscious or implicit character aspects of life. Come on, I just want to get going. I have a reasonably satisfactory life, and I want to go on.
Yeah, and all therapists get patients who press them to give them a quick fix, and sometimes you can. But I would argue that if you want to do a very focused short-term therapy, you're better off understanding the personality of the person you're working with. For example, let's say they're coming in because their perfectionism is a burden to them. They want to change their perfectionism. Well, one kind of perfectionism is typical of people with more obsessional psychologies. It involves trying to be perfect because you're trying to be good. You're trying to be the most moral person, the best person you can be. Another kind is if you have a more narcissistic orientation where you want to look good. You don't want to be shamed. You want to have a good image. Another is more from a dependent or histrionic kind of personality style. You have to be perfect because you're afraid of rejection by powerful others if you're not perfect. So you need some sense of what the perfectionism means to the person if you're going to drill down onto it and help them with it.
This is really evident in your writing, that understanding the character of the person is so important to the way the therapy unfolds, the strategies you might use, even, for instance, the use of empathy with one characteristic may be really beneficial, but it can be counterproductive with a different personality type. So this leads us to kind of your work on psychoanalytic diagnosis. You know, clinicians, we have ambivalent opinions about the DSM and diagnoses. I've been to case conferences where we can argue for an hour about a differential diagnosis.
Yeah.
Some of us really are into the arcane nuances of diagnosis. And yeah. other therapists, but also agencies, say it's stigmatizing. We don't really want to label the person. It's kind of assigning to the person a disorder when we really want to understand their life. So explain what a psychoanalytic diagnosis might be, or how you think about it, and how yeah. it's really useful. So kind of going more in depth on your example about how we might use that diagnosis to guide how we conduct the therapy.
Well, first of all, I don't think the DSM is a horrible document, but we have to appreciate what it is. It's a committee product of people that were trying to talk about, you know, observable syndromes. And it can be quite useful, but some people critique it because it's too medical, but it's actually not a very good medical model. I mean, in other areas of medicine, we don't classify people based on disorders of fever, disorders of skin rash, disorders mm-hmm. of limp. You know, those things are all observable. You can do present versus absent criteria sets for whether there's a limp or a fever or a skin rash. But we try to figure out the meaning, what's underlying this. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true of depression. I mean, we know from Sidney Blatt's research that depression can mean an internal sense of terrible emptiness, loneliness, hunger, the anaclitic type, or it can mean self-hatred, self-reproach, a sense of badness, the introjective type. And we know that different styles of psychotherapy are helpful to those. So when DSM went descriptive and categorical in 1980, that was the origin of my thinking about what kind of diagnostic thinking do we want to preserve that's actually more valuable clinically than thinking about it in terms of observable syndromes, because it leaves out meaning. And, you know, to their credit, the DSM people wanted to leave out meaning because there was controversy about meaning. And they wanted the diagnostic categories to be useful across orientations. And they wanted them to be more useful to researchers who couldn't, for example, study narcissistic personality if your definition of it was the clinical one. You know, you take the person into treatment and you see if a self-object transference develops. That's not going to help them. So I think there was a need to revise the DSM in the direction it did. But I began seeing what was going to be the downside of that. People talking about how it's affected how people think about themselves. They used to come to me saying, I'm a shy person. I need help getting more comfortable with people. And now they say, I have social phobia, as if they've been inflicted with an affliction. Mm-hmm. And there's a skill set they need, rather than that they might want to understand why people scare them and work on that together. I, by the way, I don't see any evidence, maybe you have some, that a psychoanalytically oriented approach works any slower than some of the CBT approaches that are more favored lately. I think people often stay in psychoanalytic therapy longer because they're still getting stuff out of it. But I don't think that means their symptoms reduced in a short period of time. But back to the diagnostic question, if you look at the Greek, diagnosi means to understand in a thorough way. Mm-hmm. And we do have to try to understand. Let's look at this behavior. It could be coming from a brain tumor. It could be coming from ingesting toxic substances. It could be coming from a personality issue. It could be coming from trauma. It could be coming from a temporary stress. It could have a personal private meaning to the patient. If we stop paying attention to that, we will do much more slipshod psychotherapy. Oh, these symptoms, you just target them with this set of manualized interventions. And I think that's really selling patients out. I first became aware that we needed some language to talk about clinical wisdom that had accreted over decades in the face of where the DSM was going. When I was consulting to a psychiatric hospital and they had me interview a patient, they had me interview two difficult patients, and in both cases, the patients ended up telling me stuff that they hadn't told anybody on the staff. So I was pleased. I heard one of the residents say, "Well, that's a great line she uses. I'm going to use that line." And so I went up to him and said, "I'm sorry, I've been eavesdropping. What's the line that caught your attention?" And he said, "Can you say more about that?" Okay, he was a very bright, highly motivated young psychiatrist, but he'd been trained to look at the DSM and say, is it more than 2 weeks or less than 2 weeks? Mm-hmm. And attach it to a category. And I don't think that's real diagnosis. I mean, that's just matching up to symptom lists.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, there are those who say, doing a diagnostic interview really is impersonal and turns the patient off. You know, I've told my story to my last therapist. You're asking me all these questions. I want to get to work. Let's not waste time with this kind of, it may not be a SCID structured, but it's like that. And it's quite impersonal.
Well, yeah. If you're going through a SCID structure, it's going to feel impersonal, I think. But I think a good interview is collaborative, and I haven't found. Of course, you know, I have to be a little uncertain here because people come to me often because they know I'm psychoanalytic, so I get a self-selected group. But I haven't found that people don't want to talk about themselves if you say to them things like, tell me your understanding of this problem, when it started. Do you ever remember not having it? I mean, there are ways of doing an interview more organically that will give you the information you need that is not, you know, going through another checklist of data.
And say a little more about how that engages the patient, that discussion about their problem and the meaning it has for them. I mean, what's the general structure of that session and how does it proceed? Or maybe there isn't a roadmap. It's a curiosity that can lead many different places. But I think this is important, not just for psychoanalytic therapists, but for all therapists, because in that first meeting, we want to get a comprehensive picture, at the same time engaging the patient and providing hope that there's some means to addressing this problem.
Well, I guess I skew a little bit toward the trying to make a relationship part of that dyad. And in the first session, I usually don't take an extensive history. I usually ask them, so how can I help you? And then I listen to their description. And then I find out something about the history of the problem, their own understanding of it, what they've already tried in order to solve it, questions like that. And I try to listen to what they say and eventually give some reflection to them that shows that I've been listening and trying to understand. Mm-hmm. And then toward the end of that session, I'll say, you know, for me to understand this in context, I'd like to spend at least part of the next session taking a pretty full history from you. Is that okay with you? I'll be asking you all kinds of stuff about your early life, you know, your work history, your social history, your sexual history, anything you don't want to answer, that's fine, but I need to understand the context of this problem. Mm. I haven't had people object to that, and that allows me, if they want something really short term, to develop a formulation partly with them. I do think diagnosis should be collaborative. Mm-hmm. I think even DSM diagnosis can be collaborative. I had a paranoid patient once where I said to her, you know, for insurance purposes, I have to give you a personality disorder because they're not going to give us enough session to work on what you want to work on if I don't. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, what kind of personality disorder do you think I have? And I said, here's the DSM. You look at the types. You tell me which one matches. And she said, oh, here I am, suspicious, distrustful. I'd say paranoid personality. So she made it herself. I didn't have to inflict on a paranoid person the idea that you're paranoid.
So Nancy, you write, and this was very poignant for me, that often patients will tell you things in that first session or the first two sessions that they won't tell you after a collaborative relationship is more mature. So yeah. I was interested in that. Say more about that, because I think it's a little contrary to the received view that we wait till there's a very strong relationship and then people will divulge intimate and really protected recesses of their behavior and their thoughts and so forth.
Well, I have to say I've been practicing 50 years now, and I'm always impressed with the secrets that people keep. Mm-hmm. And I could see this in myself and my own psychotherapy, how once the therapist was a really important person in my world, I got much more anxious about divulging certain things than I would have mm-hmm. to a professional stranger at the beginning. And if you're doing therapy with somebody who's working on a shameful part of the self, and it starts to come up in the work, if they can remember they did talk to you about this before and you didn't bite them or reject them or look horrified, they can work on it more easily. They can push themselves past their anxiety. But I think the problem of psychotherapy, and Hans Stripp was originally onto this in his book on psychotherapy for better or worse, that to help somebody, you have to become important to them. You have to matter, because all kinds of other people who are important to them have given them good advice and it hasn't worked. So, but power is for good or ill. If you screw up, you can hurt them. But you have to have a relationship that feels important enough to them that they're willing to take risks in that relationship. And psychotherapy improvement, as you well know as a researcher, relates a great deal to relationship issues in the therapy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But let's explore this a little further, because this idea that as the relationship becomes stronger, I don't want to disappoint or I don't want to risk disapproval of the therapist by talking about this shameful behavior. So how might you uncover some of this in the first sessions that are not available later in
just by asking about them? You know, things like routinely asking about eating disorders, sexual experience, any unwanted sexual experience, substance use. Mm-hmm. You know, people often hide substance use disorders. They'll tell you in the first session when you don't matter to them, or the second session. Mm-hmm. But then they start, you know, minimizing. So I think you're going to get, if you ask in a matter of fact way, then you won't find yourself, as I did once with a woman I'd worked with for 5 years. And she said, by the way, I've stopped puking. I said, this is news to me. She said, yeah, well, I've been bulimic my whole life, but some things changed and I'm not puking anymore. She was so ashamed of it. She'd never brought it up. And she had talked about all kinds of stuff that most people would consider shameful.
Yeah.
So there are certain things, suicidality.
So you ask about these things in the first session.
Whether or second.
Yeah.
Well, if they're depressed, I'll ask about suicidality in the first place.
But in a matter-of-fact way.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Not that I suspect you're hiding some shameful behavior, but just say, I want to get a full picture of you and what's problematic for you. So
I have subscribed to the old psychoanalytic idea that you try to get the patient to say everything, whether it's socially appropriate, whether it's shameful, whatever. And I say something like that to patients the first session. The more you can be fully honest with me, even about things that you hate in yourself, the better I'm going to be able to help you.
So that statement sets the stage for asking the questions. It's not just my purient interest in your deviant behavior, but this is important to the course of therapy. You know, I think the behaviorists and the CBT people and almost every orientation would say, well, we come up with a case conceptualization. Cognitive behavioral therapists look at learning history and so forth. So I want to ask this, there are many schools of psychoanalytic. When we go back to Freud and ego psychology and drive theory, and then we have relational schools, self-psychology, object relations.
Yeah.
Each of those is going to have a different kind of explanation for character. Does it matter which school you're from?
Not too much, I don't think.
Yeah.
I think what matters is different people resonate to different theories, you know, based on their own history and psychology and on their patient population. You know, it's not a mystery that self-psychology emerged from trying to help people with narcissistic issues, or that early Freudianism evolved from trying to work with people who had conversion symptoms, and so repression ended up being emphasized. I think all of the different approaches in psychoanalysis have a certain angle of vision, and they illuminate certain things and they miss others. And I think most practicing clinicians are not ideologues. They're quite integrative of these different points of view. One of the reasons we get so many has to do with the narcissism of therapists, because you want to invent something new and have your name put on it. This is a curse to the field in general.
Well, it's interesting, Nancy, because, you know, over the course of my career, I've listened to therapists and researchers make the claim about how important their particular approach is. And we've seen so many attributions. Well, you're not affected because you don't follow the orthodox view.
Yeah.
But when you see them work, they're much more integrative than they talk about being integrated. And that goes for not just psychodynamic therapists, but behavior therapists and all kinds of therapists. So it's an important point, I think, to make, that how we discuss these things at professional conferences or in case presentations are a bit different than what we actually do in the consulting room.
Yes, I think people, especially early in their careers, they want to know what's the right thing to do, and they may get very identified with a particular ideology within their orientation, or as opposed to other orientations. But it's humbling to practice, and the more you practice, the more you realize that everybody's on to some piece of something that's important to know. And people do get much more integrative over time. Experienced therapists look more like one another than they do like beginners in their own group.
Well, Nancy, this brings up the issue about therapist experience, because, as you know, I've done some research looking at the outcomes of therapy over the course of therapist careers, and they don't seem to actually get better over time. Now, some do, but some actually deteriorate. So on average, you don't see improvement. And I'd like to get your perspective on this, because like all of us, we think we're getting wiser and more experienced. We've seen more cases. Is this hard for you to think about, this lack of improvement? Or anyway, I'm just interested in what you think about it.
I, like everyone else, would like to believe I wouldn't make certain mistakes I made as a beginner, you know, now. And in some ways, I can see I've improved. In other ways, it's easy to coast. And I think that data probably is picking up two contradictory things. One is that beginners, they make all kinds of things that experienced people think of as mistakes, but they're so determined to help their patients that their zeal comes through and their need to help the person. And that counts for a lot. Frieder von Reichman used to always assign the untreatable patients at Chestnut Lodge to the newest residents because they didn't know they were untreatable, and they insisted in trying to help them. So the beginner's zeal can in itself compensate for a lot. And as you get older in the field, you don't have the same zeal for certain kinds of things. You know, older therapists will say, oh, God, not another narcissistic patient. I've got to listen to them drone on. And so I think there's a kind of balancing out of the assets and liabilities of different developmental levels. But I do think that, you know, therapists can get lazy like anybody else, and that we do need to keep going to conferences and meetings that nourish us. Otherwise, we get, you know, lame.
Well, we're a field where we go into a room, talk to a patient. It's confidential. Nobody really gives us very, we might get supervision, but not specific feedback about what we're doing. I mean, it's a unique profession in that way. And I kind of think about it where we've built a system. I mean, there's a reason why we do what we do, but it's not a system that provides feedback in a way that we can use to really improve.
This is true. And I would like to see more long-term research on this, more naturalistic research about, and we do know that some people tend to score better in general as therapists than others, irrespective of similarities in their training and seniority. And it would be very interesting to figure out in really naturalistic therapies what patients are staying because they're too scared to leave, or, you know, despite the fact that they're not getting help, you know, they're just in a habit. And what patients, like Oliver Sacks, for example, was in psychoanalysis for 50 years, and he just kept getting better and better, you know, he just personally as well as professionally, you know, he finally, his mother called him an abomination for being gay when he was a young man, and he went through years of, you know, very self-destructive behavior, drug taking, driving his motorcycle without a helmet, sometimes with his eyes closed. And by the time he was a sage in the field, he finally, after like 40 years of celibacy, was able to have a partner and a love life. And so, you know, some people in very long-term therapy, Bruce Springsteen is another example, really keep getting helped over the years. And others, it just seems to be a maintenance thing. That might be okay for certain people who would get worse if they weren't continuing to come. But others, it's really hard to judge whether you should still be working with somebody when you can't see a lot of change. And I always bring that up with patients. I tend to say to them, listen, the ethics of my profession prohibit me from taking your money if I don't see evidence that I'm helping you. How would you say you're being helped? And if not, what can we do about that? So I know that I deal with this as a clinician, but I don't have a lot of research to help me understand what I should be paying attention to and how to think about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this leads us to supervision. So yeah. I know you've been thinking about supervision quite a bit. So here is the role of coach or mm-hmm. expert or somebody who's helping another clinician improve. So talk about how the process of supervision may address that issue of complacency or stagnation.
Oh, yeah. I really have done more and more supervision in the last decades, including group supervisions, which I love because therapists help each other and I learn stuff. I have people from all different orientations in my supervision group. I learn things from them and they help each other. I think I got interested in doing a book on supervision because there wasn't an integrative book on psychoanalytic supervision. There were some good books on like relational supervision or, control mastery supervision, but not an integrative book. And I got interested because the American Psychological Association had wanted me to co-author a book on supervision, but they were insistent that I frame it on as a set of hierarchically organized skills. You know, first you learn to express empathy. I'm caricaturing it a bit here, but then you learn to set limits. You know. And I realized I didn't see supervision as quite like musical training or athletic training where you build on skills. It felt more of a gestalt than that for me. And I started thinking about what am I trying to do when I'm working with somebody who wants to improve their work? The first thing I'm trying to do is make them safe to say what they actually say and do. Because even if they show me videos of what they've done, they're picking which parts they show me. So I want to make them really safe talking about what actually happens. And that means, again, that you focus on the relationship and the group safety in a supervision group setting. And then you pay a lot of attention to the feelings in the room. It's not just a matter of skill. It's what feeling am I getting toward the therapist here? Is that a parallel process? Which was a phenomenon that was discovered empirically by Eckstein and Wallerstein in 1958, I believe. And Harold Searles had talked about it even earlier. But what am I feeling? What are the group members feeling toward the therapist? And is that paralleling what's going on between the therapist and the patient? And how can we think about it? Sometimes I role play in supervision. I think if you ever want to see evidence for the fact that therapists take in their patients in a deep way, you ask these very nice, loving people to role play somebody in a paranoid tirade, and this ugly stuff comes out, and then you have to deal with it. And they see you stumbling around trying to figure out how to do it, and they can identify with how you're trying to solve a problem, maybe at one piece of distance more than they have from the patient. You can think of some things that you could say or they could do that they haven't thought of because they're so caught up in the emotion of the time. I mean, one of the things that it's really hard to capture for non-clinicians is how much toxic affect we have to absorb as therapists. People that always wish we could help them faster, they're angry about paying us. There are all kinds of normal things to get irritated about in therapy, but also we get to be the targets of all kinds of old feelings and feelings toward authorities in general. And it's hard not to sort of strike back when you're being attacked.
Well, Nancy, I'm going to kind of push a little bit here because in my supervision, I've really tended to focus more on the skills that you dismissed. And this
I didn't mean to dismiss them, yeah. But I do want to say they're in the context of something larger.
Right. Context is important. But let's take this example of the interpersonally aggressive patient who's difficult, who's a little bit insulting or snide, or maybe even more direct and just says, you know, you're a lousy therapist. I wish I were getting better. But is not there a benefit to just practicing how to respond to that? So that's the context. Here's the patient. Here's the issues. In your frame, here's the structure or the scaffolding of the character. Now let's practice how to respond at that moment.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a place for that. And I think, for example, Hannah Levinson's work is very much on point for that kind of skills training. It's just that I don't want that to be the only definition of supervision. If we don't keep the relational aspects of it in mind.
What do you mean exactly by the relational aspects between the supervisor and the supervisee or the parallel process?
Both of those. But in other words, if you want to help somebody with a skill that they're not very good at, they have to really be able to tell you they're not really very good at that skill. For example, I have a supervisee who every time a patient feels negative toward him, he finds himself lecturing about the value of psychotherapy instead of going into, well, tell me how I've failed you. Say more about that, you know, and we do practice what he can say.
So, right. So you actually do practice it. So
I teach skills, sure, but I do it in the context of trying to articulate the larger situation too. That the supervisee is scared, that the supervisee has a transference to you, that the supervisee may not. I mean, we know from some research that they did in Oslo that. A lot of supervisees don't talk about certain things to their supervisors. They keep secrets. Sometimes they're on to your narcissism and they don't want to hurt your feelings if they disagree with you. Sometimes they think you won't approve. Sometimes they're worried you're evaluating them and they might differ. So I've put the emphasis much more on relational safety than on skills training. But that doesn't mean I'm not.
Well, here's kind of a phenomenon I've noticed. Is that often supervision is so focused on the countertransference, what's going on for you as a therapist, and it often ends up with some kind of attribution of deficit in the therapist, some psychological issue that they haven't faced when the truth is...
Yeah, I hate that kind of supervision. Yeah,
when the truth is... This is just a really damn hard patient to deal with.
Yeah, and the countertransference should be a matter of this is data. It's not, oh dear, you're not analyzed enough. You know, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah. Okay. So we're not too far apart, actually. So that's, we kind of talked about as we get older, we agree more. So maybe this.
And I mean, countertransference, I think, is very important to pay attention to, but not because the therapist shouldn't have it, but because it's data. Patients communicate in all kinds of ways that are not verbal, and they can tell us a lot. But I hate that style of just exposing countertransference because, you know, therapists also need skills. They need knowledge. They need information. It's not just a matter of somehow perfecting themselves.
Right. And from your perspective, the way we respond to this difficult client is really dependent on the personality structure and what you've learned from knowing the patient. So we can't say, here's the response to an interpersonally aggressive patient. You have to really know who the patient is and how they will respond to various kinds of therapist statements, but we should have the skills to be able to enact a whole repertoire of different ways. It might be empathy. It might be humility.
Yeah.
You have to know how to do those things in an effective way before you can say, which one do I want to use?
Yeah, that's one reason I like group supervision, because different people in the group will have learned different strategies and they'll have different clinical experiences. And they can say, I would try this. I would do that. Mm-hmm. And it expands people's repertoire.
Yeah, yeah. This is great. I want to come back to one point around the diagnosis. So when you formulate a diagnosis, and this isn't really specific to psychodynamic thinking, but we all have a case conceptualization yeah. in some way. As professionals, we're making inferences about something, okay? And it depends on our theoretical approach, but we are making that inference. And that goes yeah. particularly for psychodynamic therapists. So how does this relate to the concepts of autonomy and neutrality? Because as a professional, we are making inferences based on our experience, our training, our knowledge, and so forth.
Autonomy and neutrality? Or yeah. economy? Autonomy and neutrality.
Autonomy, yeah.
Okay. Well, you mean supporting the patient's autonomy as opposed
yes.
to coming
yeah.
off like a know-it-all who knows more than the patient?
Yeah. But we are making inferences based on our
yeah.
expertise. And so
yeah.
so you talk a little bit about neutrality in your writing, but I think it's important to talk about because it gets discussed in the psychoanalytic community and psychodynamic community more than other places. And I've argued with some of my psychodynamic colleagues about whether neutrality is possible or desirable.
Well, I do think that neutrality is not possible, but I do think that it's a decent aspiration, if by neutrality you mean what Anna Freud originally meant by it, that you kind of take a position equidistant from the drives, the reality considerations, and conscience, the ego and the superego. In other words, if somebody's talking about a temptation to have an affair, you don't say, go for it. You know, you don't get on the side of it. And you don't say, well, think of all the realistic ways in which you would run into trouble if you did that, because then they're not going to elaborate what's going on with them. And you don't say, well, that's immoral. Haven't you thought about the promises you made to your spouse? So you try to occupy a position that doesn't get into the conflict the way they're feeling it, because they tend to feel a conflict between different parts of the self about whatever they're suffering from. And you try to keep it open. But the idea that neutrality means that you're invisible, that they don't know who you are as a person, they know from your office decor a lot about you. Patients read your experiences quite well. So I don't think neutrality is possible in the sense of invisibility. And as far as autonomy is concerned, we are always trying to support the patient's autonomy. And I do think that any diagnostic formulation you come up with should be shared with the patient. Here's how I'm thinking about your issue. Could it be that you have a problem with closeness and distance? Because I'm hearing it here, 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 and here. What do you think? I mean, they want you to infer, but you got to then share your inferences in a humble way that they can show you is wrong if they disagree. Mm-hmm. You can't come off like a know-it-all. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you infer, but then you share and you get corrected.
Well, Nancy, I'm really glad you describe it this way, because the collaboration is so important, as we know from research. But most of that research is done in contexts other than psychodynamic or psychoanalytic, although there's a fair bit there. But you're really talking about how, in your way of working, collaboration is absolutely critical in the process.
Yeah. Yeah, I think psychoanalysts have in some ways dug their own grave. You began talking about, you know, the sort of general idea that psychoanalysis is an interesting historical anomaly. But it's because some analysts were, you know, they idealized a particular method rather than getting fascinated by the knowledge that was coming through various methods that had been thought of as psychotherapeutic. And they wanted to say, well, there's one right way to do this. And they got all rigid about it. Part of that is that, you know, at the time when some psychoanalytic institutes were forming, there had been an expose of how bad medical training was, the Flexner report. And they were trying to prove that psychoanalysis is a medical procedure. You can describe it. It's very sterile. It's just like surgery. And they took one or two lines of Freud that compared it to surgery and made that into their idea of what it was. But, you know, anybody who's had a good psychoanalytic therapy knows that it was a profoundly personal, signing up with an ideology and not obeying the rules. In fact, what patients tend to remember is when you threw the book away and did something that sort of showed them that you weren't going lockstep with somebody's rules.
Well, this leads us into an important question, and that is the future of psychodynamic and psychoanalytic psychotherapy. You know, in departments of psychiatry, psychoanalysis was top dog for a long time, being replaced by biological psychiatry. And there's lots of historical reasons for that. In clinical psych programs, you know, as they become more research-oriented and more pragmatic, CBT and manualized therapy is kind of the treatment of the day and emphasized. So what is the future of psychoanalytic psychotherapy and the approaches you're taking?
Well, I don't know, except that I think both biological psychiatry and narrow versions of manualized CBT therapies are running into their natural limits. And we're seeing an awful lot of recidivism. We're seeing, you know, the homeless schizophrenic population filling the streets. Our jails are full of mentally ill people. I think we can't emphasize enough how the insurance company's preference for very short-term work means you can't do any preventive work, and then you later on pay the price for that. I don't know whether we can turn the paradigm around in ways that will help us work more preventively. I mean, if you intervene with parents and infants, you'll do immensely more prevention than if you work with adults who have already suffered certain kinds of relational trauma, for example. I think psychoanalytic therapies are probably going to last in some form because we do help people and they know it, and they seek out other therapists who are similar. And there is increasingly an empirical literature on specific psychoanalytic approaches that is finally beginning to accrete so that we can say we have evidence-based therapies. But I don't know. I think we're up against the power of the drug companies, the power of the insurance companies, the needs of public figures to claim that they can solve problems in the short term rather than investing in helping people in the long term. I mean, I think at least the psychoanalytic community has a language for talking about some of the ways we're all suffering now. And I do think if you make psychoanalytic knowledge accessible, which analysts haven't been very good at, they use impenetrable jargon, they talk to each other, people are very responsive to it. And as I said, you know, CBT colleagues, when they come to me and present their cases, they don't work all that differently from me. And they tend to think in a slightly different language. I might talk about defense, and they might talk about, a deficit in cognitive reframing or something. But we are looking at the same suffering animal. And I do think the future of psychotherapy is in integrative therapies. I'm a member of the Society for the Exploration of Psychotherapy Integration. I do think that we need to respect the work of people like John Norcross and realize that psychotherapy is best understood as a healing relationship within which you apply certain techniques. It's not the techniques themselves. Mm-hmm. We need more emphasis on what is a therapeutic relationship like. Miller and Moyers just put out a book on the qualities of therapists that correlate with improvement. And none of them have to do with following manualized treatments.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I when people ask me to break down what we do in psychotherapy is we use this relationship in a powerful way to help people learn new ways of being in the world.
And
it's when you say it that way, they go, well, yeah, we all do that. The relationship is important, partially because it's a powerful way to persuade people to do something they're afraid to do.
Yes.
And partly because where else in life do you have somebody who is going to empathically be present with you, no matter what you say, with some limitations, of course. But that's a tremendous gift. And if you take those two aspects, I think we all do variants of that. Now, the CBT people help people do something different than you might do or I might do, but it's still something that really is beneficial for them and is difficult to do. They need that persuasion to be able to do it.
Yeah, they need a safe harbor from which to venture out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Nancy, this is very exciting and as always interesting to talk to you. I think in this interview we've come across clinical wisdom that we need to keep in mind as we do therapy. So I'm extremely pleased you agreed to do this and have enjoyed the hour.
Well, I was honored to be selected to do this. I hope I have spoken for, a whole group of therapists who are in the trenches trying to help suffering people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths offers a complete behavioral health EHR and practice management software solution, including claims, billing, clinical notes and documents, scheduling, and teletherapy, all for one simple and affordable monthly price. CarePaths EHR is HIPAA compliant and ONC certified, and can also support electronic prescribing for an additional fee. With CarePaths Connect, clinicians can enroll their clients in automated measurement-based care and create a digital front door for their practice. If you're just starting your practice or are dissatisfied with your current EHR, go to carepaths.com to start your free trial today. If you are currently in therapy and want to know how to get the most out of your treatment, check out the free Making Therapy Better app and visit makingtherapybetter.com.